Humanity in Healthcare is seeing and being seen, and hearing and being heard, and healing and being healed.
More human healthcare means I know what matters to my patients, not just what's the matter with
them. And more human healthcare means extending kindness, compassion and fair treatment, regardless of my faith, nationality and race. Remembering that underneath it all, we're all human.
More human healthcare means remembering everyone involved is human.
As staff, it would mean the umbrella of safety and compassion is extended to me. As a patient, it would mean not to be unfavorably cared for because of who I am.
More human healthcare means a warm and listening face, an attitude of respect, and an honest and open response.
Humanized healthcare for me is more than just dressing my wounds. It's holding my hand, looking into my eyes, asking how I feel. It's checking that I'm not scared, treating me like a human being.
My name's Beth Fitzsimons and I work for the Point of Care Foundation. I'd like to welcome you to our new podcast series, which is all about humanising healthcare. And this is the first episode, and this is called Because People, Not Bodies, Suffer. And to have a conversation with me today, I would like to welcome Jocelyn Cornwell, who is the founder of the Point of Care Foundation and who's been with this mission right from the start 15 years ago. So it's lovely to talk to you, Jocelyn.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So Jocelyn, you've been pursuing this mission of humanising healthcare for a very long time. And really, I suppose I wanted to ask why we even need to be having a conversation about humanising healthcare. I mean, after all, isn't that what care is all about?
So I think the best way that I can perhaps talk about this is to illustrate it with a couple of stories. So the first one would be about my niece, and I wrote about it in a blog recently for the Point of Care. But the story was that she was 26 weeks pregnant and she had been bleeding on and off since the beginning of her pregnancy with her second child, bleeding more each day. And so she was admitted to hospital for observation and just in case anything happened. And she was there for 4 weeks and threatened to deliver the baby every single day. And every single day that she was there, she saw a different doctor who was in charge. She had discussed a plan of care at the beginning with the consultant, but every doctor every day changed the plan without referring back to the previous plan, and just said to her, this is what we're doing now. And as time went by, quite quickly, I would say, even by just week two, Claire was, she was really, her anxiety levels were sky high because of the lack of continuity in terms of her care and in terms of the relationships. She just didn't know who she could turn to, who she could talk to. Plus, to add to her difficulty, she wasn't allowed to have visitors because of COVID, even though, very strangely, she was on a postnatal ward and the fathers of the women who had had their babies were allowed to visit. So that's like the first story. And the second story is one that's been in the news for months, which is that people are dying in hospital with COVID without family members being able to see them. And again, this has happened within my extended family, and I've seen the impact of it on the family who are left behind. And I can't begin to think what it must be like for the patient. And so my question really about that particular COVID-related thing is, how did this happen? What were the conversations that happened in hospitals when the decisions were taken right at the beginning that should be excluded, and who was involved? And my hunch is that the decision was taken on the basis of infection control and clinical reasons, and that there was no one there whose only job would represent the interests of patients and families. And I'm not necessarily saying that it will be different, although I think you can see that it could be different if you read the interview with Hayley Hughes, which is on the Point of Care Foundation website. But the fact is that we don't have anyone inside organisations, inside services, whose job it is to think about what is it like for patients and their families. And so for me, those two stories really say a lot about the need, about why we're talking about humanising healthcare, because patients do have a unique perspective. No one else knows what it's like being on the receiving end of services, and a high quality service means that care is personal, but it really often doesn't feel personal. And the sort of problems that my niece had are very common: not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing who's responsible, not being able to find someone to talk to. And if I may, I know this is a long answer, but there's also very good evidence that the quality of care varies and it's better for some people than for others. It's better if you can speak up for yourself, if you're cooperative and grateful. It's not so good if you've got learning disabilities, if your behaviour is difficult, if you've got dementia. And there's been really a lot of reports that should cause us concern, that show what can happen, that things can go badly wrong, and that when they do, the NHS as a whole closes ranks, defends itself against outsiders. And I'm thinking there about Mid Staffordshire and Shrewsbury, and that report even just last year on the Independent Medicines and Medical Devices Review. So that would be my argument.
So having said all that then, if you had to sort of sketch out a blueprint, you know, if I'm coming into post, I've sort of come from outer space and I want to make this thing happen, what does it look like? What does it even mean? If you've got a humanised system, how would you tell?
I think if you're from outer space and you're going to be a healthcare professional, it means that what I'm to do is have the patient as a person in mind, and to try always to talk, when you're talking about patients or thinking about them, to think about them as real people and not as objects for clinical care or interesting medical problems, and not to use language that objectifies the organ that's a problem, you know, the kidney patient or the patient, or talk about them in terms of the bed that they're in, the patient in bay 4. I mean, that's at the level of the individual professional, that they're able to hold patients in mind. But I think that staff can only do that if they have really good support. And if you're looking at it from the point of trying to look at an organisation and say, is the care that's delivered here, is it delivered in a human way? I think for me, you would see an organisation that thought a lot about its staff as people and tried to think about their mental and emotional well-being. Because that organisation, the most senior people in it, would understand that patient care is very demanding, very exhausting, that patients are often very difficult to deal with for all sorts of reasons. So I think the organisation has to have the staff in mind, just as we want the professionals to have the patients in mind. But I also think that it's an organisation that asks patients about their experience and involves them in the decisions that it takes, because it's an organisation that understands that running an organisation or delivering care is one thing that they know a lot about, but what they don't know about is what it's like being a patient. And for that, they need to hear from their patients, and they need to hear from them in a whole variety of ways, and they need to listen to them. That's what I think it would look like.
And what do you say to people who say, you know, especially at the moment, there's a lot of this, it's about life and death, and some of this is the sort of niceties, and it really is it boils down to the clinical care, which has got to be top priority.
This is just nice to have, but it doesn't really matter as long as the clinical care is okay.
Well, I think that is That is something we've heard a lot over the years, probably a bit less now than when we started out on this work 15 years ago. But some people put it, the experience of patients as people, as a lower priority than the clinical care. What would you say to that?
I would say that was setting a very low bar. And that, I think there's lots of things I want to say about that. First of all, there's a lot of evidence that, people's minds and bodies are connected. And just going back to the story about my niece, the level of stress and anxiety that she experienced was just clearly extraordinarily bad for her, and probably bad for her baby as well, and unnecessary. It wasn't either or. Either she was well looked after clinically, or they paid attention to her as a person. They didn't have to do very much to do both. It was just that the care of the person wasn't paid attention to. There's very good evidence from different parts of medicine, including recovery from surgery, including chronic care, that the care of the person as a whole makes a difference to the clinical outcomes. But also, I think it's very important for staff. I think the staff want to feel that they're able to look after people properly. Staff get very demoralized, I think, if they feel like they're just part of a kind of big factory system that's caring for patients as objects. So I think it's important in the round.
I mean, that sort of leads me on to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, really, which is, you know, there are, of course, examples of fantastic care, and we see lots of that, as well as some of the stories that, like the ones you describe about your niece. And people go into work in healthcare for the best of reasons, don't they? They go into healthcare to look after people, and it matters to them that they look after people well. So what gets in the way of the hospitals and the systems operating in this way?
Well, I think it's important to think about the history of healthcare and where it's come from. And the history is one that's paternalistic. Medicine is paternalistic in its point of view, as it were. And I think that that still pervades the system as a whole, that doctors and the people providing services know best. And I think it's deeply embedded in the culture. And I think cultural change is very hard to do. And healthcare organisations are extremely complex, which makes it harder. I think at an individual level, for healthcare professionals, for support staff, it takes enormous courage to speak up against the status quo, to say to other people on your team, why are we doing it like that? Or could we do it differently? I think you have to have a certain amount of confidence. Quite simply, we don't, the people running services don't get enough exposure to patients' perspectives. Really, they get very little feedback. The feedback that they see tends to come from patient surveys. And so they're presented in terms of numbers rather than stories. And listening to patients' stories, even the story just of my niece, is very powerful, I think, and tells you a lot. But medicine traditionally is a culture, and, you know, it's based on science and evidence. And stories are suspicion rather than valued. So I think there's all sorts of things that combine, and that, I mean, I've only mentioned some of them. It's a very, very big question.
So if you had to start somewhere, and, you know, what two or three things would you like to see which would mean that you felt that the system was moving in the right direction for this to be in place, for people to be considered as people?
If I ruled the world, I would, if I could, want clinicians and managers to be required to shadow patients regularly for a number of hours, perhaps. You know, want them to step out of role and, as part of their job, to be part of their kind of professional updating, to shadow a patient for 2 or 3 hours, just to remind themselves what it's like being a patient, and particularly to find out what it's like being a patient in the service that they're responsible for. I would like in the system much more, you know, as a whole, from NHS England down through the regulators and trust boards, I'd like patient-centered care to be a priority of equal status to patient safety and clinical effectiveness. That has been a declared policy since 2008, that the patient's experience should be a priority, that there's kind of 3 points of a triangle that create a quality service: patient-centered care, patient safety and clinical effectiveness. But I think the patient-centered part of it does not have equal priority to the other two and doesn't get as much attention and isn't considered to be important as your earlier question suggested. And I think perhaps the third thing was that would be that every trust should have someone at board level who's responsible for experience, whose job it is to say, what is it this going to be like for patients and families, and to make that their business.
Sometimes these, when we talk about these things, it can paint a slightly bleak picture. And I guess I would want to finish by asking, are there grounds for optimism? Is there anything that gives you hope that we're moving in the right direction?
I think there's lots of reasons to be optimistic. I think things have changed enormously in the last 15 years since point of care started. I think that the healthcare system is trying much more seriously to involve patients. And I think there are many, many more people who've been exposed to training in working differently with patients, whether it's doing shadowing or doing co-design with patients. I don't think you do hear as much challenge as you did 15 years ago to the idea that patients' experience is important. I think that during the pandemic, there's been ample evidence of how much staff really care and are aware of the importance of the humanity of care. And I hope that as we come out of the pandemic, that will be an important kind of touchstone for thinking about ways in which the system has to be reformed. I think that during the pandemic, we've seen that healthcare can change absolutely fundamentally when it has to. I mean, just say the movement is towards all this video conferencing that's happening with patients instead of outpatient appointments shows you how rapidly things can change when it's really needed. So I don't have any doubt that the system can change, and I hope that this kind of profound sense of how much the humanity of care matters is held on to as people think about the future.
Thanks for talking to us today. And we're going to be having more of these conversations over the next few weeks, particularly around some of those aspects of care where these are fundamentally sort of existential experiences. They're coming into the world, they're going out of the world. And so there will be lots more opportunities for us to talk about these things and think about what we can do to make a reality out of humanising healthcare. So my thanks to Jocelyn Cornwell for spending her time with us today and for sharing her insights with me. If you want to find out more about the Point of Care Foundation and our mission to humanise healthcare, you can visit us at pointofcarefoundation.org or at Point of Care Foundation on Twitter. Thanks so much for listening to this first Point of Care Foundation podcast. I hope you like what you heard, and we'll look out for our next episode on humanising the healthcare associated with death and dying, when I'll be joined by Point of Care Foundation Chair Richard Smith and Libby Salner. Until then, goodbye.